For the week of September 29th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 207, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in a secure bunker where I'm trying to quickly watch the last seven episodes of Breaking Bad without hearing any spoilers, I'm Michael Giltz.
How about this? I haven't watched a single episode of Breaking Bad, and so I haven't been on Twitter in 24 hours, and I'm going to let it go probably another 24 hours, because I figure all of the Breaking Bad stuff will have washed through by then.
You don't even want to see spoilers. That's how much you don't care about this show.
It's not that I don't care, it's that I never started it, and now I feel like I've missed something because everybody in the world is talking about it. The Pope, the other day I heard, talking about some kind of religious thing, and then he mentioned Breaking Bad.
Shut up.
I'm kidding. But
okay. You actually got me there. Well, what if the Pope was listening to our show? What would he hear about?
Well, on today's show, he would hear about how the Academy Awards are changing the way animated films are nominated for Oscars. Now, the new rules are in line with all the other recent amendments the Academy has made. But what will it mean, these rule changes, for this year's Best Animated Feature category? Maybe nothing, maybe something. We'll discuss. The new television season started last week, as you know, Michael, and some preliminary ratings results are finally in. It's mostly good news for NBC this year, at least. That's kind of unlike, well, just about every season for the past 5 years. We'll explain. We're also going to be changing up our Inside Baseball this week by including a listener email. We'll take you into what has become the contentious world of object-based audio and the argument over open standards in the film industry and how that could affect not only the future of cinema, but also the sound we hear at home. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, I am. And of course, we're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. The number one movie in the entire world is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, a film from someone Sperling knows somehow, I think. It grossed $35 million worldwide, basically opened just in North America, but it is the number one movie around the world.
Wait, how do I know somebody from this film?
Don't you know somebody who wrote the picture book it's based on or something?
Not
I thought you had a tie into Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I'm completely wrong. Oh, well. All right, I guess I'm wrong. The number two movie around the world is, did I write down this title? Young Detective D.
And the blah, 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 blah.
Well, yes, and the Phantom Flame. No, that was the first one. This is Young Detective D, Rise of the Sea Dragon. It's a prequel to the movie Detective D, Mystery of the Phantom Flame, which came out in 2010, I believe. So it's off to a solid start worldwide. It made $17 million in about five markets. And number three around the world is Rush, the Ron Howard film about Formula One car racing. It grossed $16 million. It's made $30 million worldwide so far. At number four is Prisoners, the Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal drama that grossed another $15 million. It's at $45 million and counting. And number five is Insidious Chapter 2, the horror film franchise. It made another $11 million. It's at $84 million. At number six, one of the big news of the last few weeks, Instructions Not Included, the Mexican film, it's both in Spanish and English, grossed another $11 million. It's at $64 million and counting. In North America, in the U.S., it's made $38 million because it hasn't opened in Canada yet. This is a little unusual, but it's made $38 million in the U.S. It's the highest grossing Spanish language film of all time in that market. It just passed Pan's Labyrinth, the great film by Guillermo del Toro. It's the fourth highest grossing foreign language film in U.S. box office history.
I was surprised that Amelie was not on that list.
Well, what is on that list?
Pan's Labyrinth, right? And then you have...
number one is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
You think? Okay, yeah.
Is the highest grossing foreign language film. And then you have Hero, I believe that's in there as well.
Life is Beautiful.
Is that the number two one?
I think so. It goes Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Life is Beautiful, Hero, and then I believe now, then Pan's Labyrinth, I think. And,
right.
And then...
In U.S., Amelie grossed $33 million.
Oh, okay. So
that's
yeah.
a terrific amount of money for a French language film.
That's
it's
true.
It's just not quite as high as $38 million.
That's true. Also true. Adjusted for inflation, though. No, just kidding.
So that's a huge success story that we've been talking about for quite a while. Every studio head is now going, we need a Latino film. At number seven is Runner Runner. This movie grossed $11 million overseas. It hasn't opened in North America. It opens on Friday. It's a thriller about online gambling starring Justin Timberlake and Ben Affleck. I hadn't even heard about it, but they've opened it up in Russia and a number of other countries, and it started off with pretty good numbers. And number eight is We're the Millers, the comedy was starring Jennifer Aniston of Cheers. Another $10 million.
Cheers.
Cheers. I mean, Friends.
Yes.
Another $10 million. That's at $237 million. At number nine, is it a success? Is it a failure? Don John, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt writing, directing, and starring project. It grossed $9.5 million worldwide. Now, that's, some people said it was a so-so opening for this movie. It was pretty good, but, you know, it didn't quite beat out some other movies at the box office. Like in North America, it was passed up by Baggage Claim, which is a romantic comedy from Fox Searchlight. Don John, however, cost $6 million to make. So if you can gross more than your budget on opening weekend, that's pretty darn good, right?
Yeah, plus, you know, Relativity, again, this is just in the U.S. mostly. There's $500,000 out there somewhere in some other market. However, $9 million in the U.S. came in fifth. It's gotten a lot of buzz. Relativity Media is distributing the film. They paid $4 million for it out of Sundance.
And so they tripled, they more than doubled the budget. However, they promised to spend $27 million on marketing.
Yeah, $25 million. On marketing.
Oh, I thought it was 20 on marketing. Well, now there you go. We don't often know what the marketing costs are. We sort of just go off the budget. You need to double your budget in order to start making money. So if by that standard, hey, they're already doing pretty darn good, but they spent $25 million on marketing, or they will when all is said and done. That means that it costs them about $29 million to make this movie, right?
Right.
So now you need to make $60 million in order to start making a profit, because they don't have worldwide rights. They only have North American rights.
Right. And theatrically, you're right. If they make back all of their, you know, money,
they need to gross $60 million in North America,
right,
to break even.
To, yeah, roughly. I think that in this case, they will probably
do it.
Lose a little bit of money theatrically, unless this movie, it has good word of mouth, and I have seen it.
It has a C plus cinema score. It does not have good word of mouth from audiences necessarily. It's gotten some pretty good reviews from critics and some mixed reviews. The clips with Scarlett Johansson look very funny. I kind of want to see it. I know some people who saw it and were disappointed, but I'm sort of intrigued, I must say. So and I'm a big Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan, so I should show him support and check it out. But they're not going to make six times their budget unless next week the word of mouth is off the charts. And from what we can tell, word of mouth from the average moviegoer is not off the charts.
Yeah, and you never know the way that
these... And that's a fact.
You never know the way these deals are structured either. It could have been, we guarantee $25 million, asterisk, in marketing and advertising. However, you know, if they don't perform up to certain levels by week two, then that drops. I mean, there very well may be. We didn't spend $25 million up front.
But more often you will be these days, because movies open so strong. They open front load. And frankly, the P&A budget would go up if it had a long run, because you wanted to goose it. If it was doing really well, like Instructions not included, whatever they promised to spend on prints and advertising, or however they planned it, I'm sure that's dramatically increased now, because they've got a long range hit on their hands.
Yes, this is like my Big Fat Greek Wedding issue, where you open in like 100 theaters and all of a sudden you need to have, you know, 2,000 prints struck because you're doing, you know, $100 million worth of tickets.
So Joseph Gordon-Levitt made this film. He made it for $6 million. He sold it for $4 million in the U.S. He sold it overseas. He's made back the money for his investors. So that is a great triumph for him, whatever happens to this movie. The studio has released the film. It's got a pretty good opening, I think, I would say. For the type of film it is starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I feel like it's quite a strong start.
It's the kind of start that helps propel you right into home video and ancillary markets to actually earn all of your profit, which is the way some of these films are made these days.
Exactly. So I think it's a solid start. They're not going to make their money back at the box office unless something miraculous happens, but we'll have to see where it ends up. At number 10 around the world is Baggage Claim, the romantic comedy that opened just behind Don John. It made $9.3 million in the U.S. alone. At number 11 is Smurfs 2, another $8 million. That's at $320 million and counting. At number 12 is Planes, another $8.6 million around the world. $170 million is where it's at right now. At this point, it could quadruple its budget. So again, you know, it tarnished the image of Pixar and Disney. They don't care. They're making money.
Yeah, they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, number 13 is Elysium. It's at $263 million and counting. And number 14 is Two Guns, which has gone back into some markets. It's made another $7 million. It's still at $91 million worldwide and counting, so it's still a bit of a disappointment. At number 15, The Conjuring. That's just under $300 million worldwide. And at number 16 is Blue Jasmine, the Woody Allen film. Another $6 million, with a lot of that being made overseas. It made $5.5 million overseas and $700,000 in North America. So that's at $40 million worldwide.
Now, I was going to mention that White House Down is still on the charts along with Turbo at 17 and 18. $6.1 million for Turbo, of course, not in the U.S. anymore. $6 million for White House Down. And, still, Turbo, 182 million cum, worldwide cum. I don't think that movie makes money.
Well, no, obviously not yet. It costs $135 million to make, at least as far as we know. So it has to get to at least 270. Typically, a family film would have great, home video possibilities. So the story's not written yet. But yeah, it's certainly nowhere near to profitability. White House Down, I think they had a budget of $150 million.
Well, then only $194 million isn't going to cut the,
Right. So you always want to keep an eye on these movies and see how they do overseas. That's where a lot of ground can be made up. But, they're starting that far down. It's hard for them to get back to profitability. However, White House Down made $70 million in the U.S., doubling that overseas certainly takes a sting out of how much money you're going to lose.
Did you see any of these movies over the weekend, whether it's Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs?
I was with my family in Allentown, and we were making pasta.
Okay. But did any of that pasta have meatballs in it? And were they giant pieces of pasta that maybe were draped
across? Sausage. Here's what I want to talk. I want to talk about Cloudy, because I happened to almost not glance at Variety, but I finally looked at the Variety box office summary, which I don't really need, but there was one line in there that really intrigued me. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2 earned 28% of its box office from 3D. 28%. The original movie earned 60% from 3D and IMAX when it opened. And that means ticket sales are probably 25%, 23%. So over 75% of the ticket sales for this movie were in 2D. That is as clear a rejection of 2D for family 3D for family films as I can imagine.
Okay, now you had a bit of a qualifier on there. So you're absolutely correct. Uh-huh. And the qualifier being for family films, because when you go to the movies and it's 3D.
But that's where studios thought they were going to make 3D hand over fist. Every animated film was 3D because the 3D looks best in animated.
Well,
it's the easiest to do. It looks good.
Yeah.
But people hate it. People hate it.
Well, they certainly hate paying extra when their kids are going to complain about it.
And you know what? If it was the same price, I bet you wouldn't get up above 50% still. I think kids would still say, I don't want to wear those stupid glasses.
That's absolutely correct.
Think about that. Even if it was the same price, people would reject it for 3D. You're still going to see important live action movies and some animated ones that click in 3D, like Avatar or The Hobbit this Christmas or Gravity on Friday with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. I was surprised actually when Ann Stockwell mentioned that it was in 3D. I hadn't even realized.
You mean Ann Thompson?
Ann Thompson. I hadn't even realized it was a 3D film.
Yes, and
from the reviews I'd seen, I didn't have people emphasizing over and over, but she insists the 3D is really important to this movie, right?
Yes, and she's not the only one insisting that. Almost every critic I've read has said the same thing, that it really, like Avatar, pushes the medium forward and advances the art form.
And you said you want to see it in 3D.
Right.
So, and I'm perfectly ready and able and willing to see that this movie will do very well in 3D, over 50% perhaps on opening weekend, and that will still happen for many years to come. But 3D as an everyday occurrence for movies, it's dead. The sweet spot was supposed to be family films, animated movies.
Well, and I think
and summer blockbusters, and it's not happening.
Yes. And I think that ultimately, back when Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, the original film, was released, it was still...
Which somebody. He's like a neighbor. And you know the person who wrote the book or something. No?
No,
I don't know. What am I thinking of? Anyway, keep going.
Well, I think, it was in the heyday or the rise of 3D. And so a lot of people were still going to the movies wanting to experience that. A. B, there were more showtimes in 3D than there were in 2D. This time, the other way around. For me to see this film in 3D, there were like one or two showings per day.
Well, that's because people don't want it. And the theater owners are saying, why are we having half-empty theaters with 3D? And that's the death knell of 3D. It's not because the showtimes were there for several years, but they're finally pulling back because they realize it's a money-losing proposition. Now, you look at Gravity on Friday, I would say the 3D outnumbers the 2D like 2-1. if not more. From what I can see in New York City, there are two or three times as many screenings of it in 3D as there are in 2D. Because this is a movie that they think is going to work in 3D. But it's going to be the exception, not the rule. And the reason there are fewer showtimes is because people rejected it. And you were having one third of the screenings were full and two thirds were half empty. And that's just dumb. Theater owners won't keep doing that.
Rush, you didn't see that either.
No, I like Daniel Brühl, who co-stars in the movie. So I kind of want to see it for that reason. But it costs $45 million to make, which cannot include back end for Ron Howard, because he must not have gotten a big... He took a cut to make this movie and said, I'll make my money on the back end, right? $45 million.
Either that, or he basically said, I will make my money through making this movie independently and then selling it to different distributors. And well, so I don't have to make my director's fee.
Is that how he did it?
That's another way to make money by doing
this. No. But is that what he did? I thought it was an independent company that made the movie. I didn't think he made it himself with his own money.
I don't know the particulars.
No, unless you know that's true, I would assume it's not. He's not stupid enough to budget his own $45 million movie. He's not that desperate, but it's his second independent film in his career. His first was his debut film as director, Grand Theft Auto. And I wish he'd copyrighted that, because he could have made a lot of money off the video game.
Yeah, I was going to say, which spawned a series of popular billion-dollar video games.
It has nothing to do with the video game. Right? Grand Theft Auto is a legal phrase, so it's not something that you can own the rights to as such.
Right.
So, yeah, so Ron Howard made that movie. It cost $45 million budget. It's an independent film. I don't believe he formed a company to make it.
No. Imagine Entertainment, his company, made the film, along with a bunch of co-producers and the like.
Yeah. Well, I think he's got a back-end thing. I don't think, it wouldn't filter directly to him. I don't think he's cut his fee. Here's a question, though. What happened to the number one movie of the week?
The number one
movie of the week last week was The Face Reader, this South Korean film that opened at $15 million, then jumped up its second week and was the number one film in the world last weekend. And now it looks like it's dropped down to about $5 million this weekend. That's what it made. I have no idea what's going on there, The box office overseas in South Korea is a mystery to us unless someone writes about it. It's made $50 million so far, but what the heck happened to it, I have no idea. How you could open, increase, and then drop by 75%, I don't know. But if you're wondering what happened to that movie we talked about quite a while for the last two weekends, I can't tell you.
Well, maybe Michael Bay directed it, and like all of his films, it dropped off 75% after opening weekend.
Well, but it was two weekends. It opened, increased its second weekend. That's what's so perplexing.
I should say that if there's somebody out there listening who knows a bit about the South Korean box office and its intricacies, please feel free to write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address.
All right. Now, it's pretty easy to sum up, Sir Berling. What have the Oscars done about animated movies? What is the big change that they've made?
Well, originally, the way this worked was there were some volunteers here in Los Angeles, and they would have to be available.
Not volunteers. Anybody could do it who wanted to.
But you had to be a part of the Academy.
Steven Spielberg could be, in the Academy. It wasn't that people anybody who wants to go see the documentary films or the animated films or foreign language films, anybody could do it. You just had to be available. And it ended up being retirees because not a lot of people had a certain time and space to set aside to go to an actual screening. So Spielberg could have gone. It's not like only certain people were allowed to do it. Anyone could do it.
You had to be available. See all of them. And you couldn't just go, I saw these three. But now there's like 20 movies that have to be seen. So, they're trying to make it easier for their 6,000 members to actually participate in the nomination process for animated films.
Right. So what they're doing is sending out screeners, right?
They're saying, guess what, guys? You don't have to come every weekend in November to see three movies a day. You can, we'll just send out screeners, and now you can vote by screeners. And guess what? You don't have to be in LA.
Right. So it's just like documentaries and short subject films. They're saying we have screeners available. We should just send them out so that more people can help pick the nominees and help pick the winners. Right.
Right. And do you think this will affect the films that are nominated, the animated films that are nominated for Best Animated Feature or even, I guess Best Animated Feature really, at this year's Academy Awards?
Well, the more options, the more people that participate, the more it will reflect what the Academy members actually think, and you won't get weird, quirky choices where major films are ignored or major documentaries are ignored because only eight people saw them and they have their own particular tastes. It evens it out to reflect the most popular and best films that were released this year, though frankly, it's a pretty weak year for animated films from the major studios.
What about Miyazaki's film? This is the Japanese filmmaker who's retiring. He's an animator, the world-renowned, famed animator. He's made his last film this year.
Which was called?
Don't ask me these questions. I completely forgot.
I thought you were going to talk about it. No. I wasn't trying to trick you. Yeah.
I almost didn't mention it because I thought...
His last film is The Wind Rises.
Yes,
which,
thank you.
I believe is scheduled for a theatrical release. I saw it at the New York Film Festival. I thought it was a solid finale to his career. It's certainly he's beloved by Hollywood, by everybody in the animation world. So it's certainly very likely to get a nomination. I don't think it's necessarily the type of film that would win, but if it's a weak year, it could, you know, it's not the overwhelming masterpiece that is, you know, Spirited Away or My Neighbor Totoro or something like that. But it is a lovely grace note and a finale to his career. It fits in with the themes of his career. It's an interesting movie. It's certainly not for little, it's not inappropriate for kids, but it's not really geared towards children. You know, it's about an aeronautical engineer in between the wars.
Yes, so, definitely a children's movie.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, but that's the great thing about it. I said, look, you don't have to. It's not adult in the sense that it pushes the boundaries of sex and violence, like, say, a Ralph Bakshi film. It's just a film about an adult subject, a subject that adults would be interested in. It's not a kiddie film about fantasy or whatever. It's just a film that could have been made in live action, but he chose to tell it this way, and it has his magical sensibility and his love of flying and dreams and that sort of thing. And it's a very peace-embracing movie. This poor man loves flying and loves planes, but is doomed to be making them in an era where they're going to be used for war. It could actually, in this year, without a lot of great movies from Pixar or Disney coming out, that it could, you know, sneak in and win the Oscar.
Is there a talking daikon radish in the film?
I do not believe so.
Okay, because there wasn't a couple of his other movies, or at least one of them that I can remember.
Right. So it's always good that you have you know, more people helping to make the choices of the nominations and the winners. It's always a good thing, I think, because it will make sure that it better reflects popular sensibility of what the best movies of the year are. You don't have these bizarro quirks. But the movie does have a romantic element to it. Our hero falls in love with a woman, and in classic Japanese film tradition, she has consumption, and she looks more beautiful the closer she gets to death. So, you know, it's not exactly a romantic comedy, but it is a romantic drama.
Well, you know, it's a good thing it's not a romantic comedy, because if it was, then it wouldn't get a release at all, according to, well, this story in The Hollywood Reporter that says, hey, romantic comedies, they're dead. Well, and I guess the title of the story, the article here is RIP Romantic Comedies, Why Harry Wouldn't Meet Sally in 2013.
So why are romantic comedies dead?
Well, they're saying that
he said skeptically.
Yeah, well, that's the question. I guess you have lots of producers, including Linda Obst, saying, you know, she can't get, and she's known for romantic comedies, or at least was in the past. She produced Sleepless in Seattle and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and several others. She's saying, I can't get a romantic comedy past the studios these days. They're usually around $20 to $40 million to produce. They want to maybe produce one a year. They're focused solely on these franchise films, these big budget $250 million films that can be blockbusters, popcorn movies, and I can't get these romantic comedies passed.
So they're out of favor, but is there something there to say they're dead? Seems a little silly to me.
I think it's a lovely clickbait headline.
What will the headline be next week? Romantic comedies are back.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's some talk
because
about...
Because if nobody is making a romantic comedy, what would you as a smart studio executive do? Say, hey, I got the field to myself. I can make these movies that have an audience and set myself apart. It's great counter-programming. It's great. You can make three or four of them cheaply. And then guess what? You know, you're going to hit yourself a hit.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, part of the issue that some of these producers are facing is that these movies are, you know, comedy in general, all talk, lots of talk. Unless it's
they don't travel overseas,
it won't. They don't travel well overseas traditionally, and so the studios are focused on films that can have a little bit more of an international appeal, since 60-70% of the box office is coming from international markets. Now, the Hollywood Reporter also goes on to say that there is a quote decreasing appeal of young movie stars in translating into less demand for romantic pairings.
What?
They say that there is these young movie stars are less appealing. Effectively. And I wonder, and I don't know whether they meant physically and financially or just financially or just physically. I don't know. But I wonder if a part of that is because with these big blockbuster movies, they're casting Johnny Depp again and Brad Pitt again. And so there's no young talent rising. I don't think that's the case.
I don't know what you're saying. There are no new young movie stars. And so there's nobody to star in these romantic comedies. I mean, Brad Pitt gets box office and Johnny Depp because they make money. That's movie stars last for decades. That's what happens.
Right. I guess is there a wave of new young movie stars coming?
Well, yeah.
That is appealing.
Aren't there? Don't you have Ryan Gosling and Jake Gyllenhaal? Well, he's been around a while now, but you know, I mean, there's always new young Turks coming up and attractive young women, right?
I agree. Emma Stone.
Right. She can't star in a romantic comedy?
No, I think she has, in fact.
Right.
Crazy Stupid Love.
It's just a stupid article, right? It's stupid.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
the Western died, but that's a very rare genre where it really, really died. And of course, you every once in a while you make a Western, but still, the Western really did die. I mean, it dominated television. They were made constantly for 50, 60, 70 years in the movies, and then they really did die. But that's pretty rare. The gangster movie is still made, the sci-fi, the horror flick, the romantic comedy, the drama. I mean, period pieces. Movie genres don't really die too often. And I can't imagine people don't want to watch attractive people fall in love. Really? That's gone out of style? I can't imagine. You tell me Ryan Gosling can't star in a romantic comedy?
Well,
not that he's a huge star. He makes more edgy, weird films. He's not trying to make that type of film. But there are plenty of attractive
Crazy
young
Stupid actors. Love.
Right. But I'm just saying in general, you know, he doesn't live in the romantic comedy world. But
no, he lives in the real world.
That's right. It just seems to me that it's strange to say that romantic comedies are gone.
No, but you know what I'm going to do?
Especially the Hollywood Reporter. I would expect that at like some general interest magazine or newspaper. But it's true that they're having trouble getting them greenlit. Why is that? Because studios are not making the proper mix of movies. You want to have a mix of big budget and franchise movies, but you also got to have smaller budget movies. You don't know where the next hit's going to come from or the next star. It's bad, bad business decision, I think.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, but that's not the way the trend that Hollywood is taking.
And
what's
the number five movie or four movie this week? Baggage Claim out in North America.
Precisely, and that's where I was headed, yeah.
Coming up is About Time from Richard Curtis. The Best Man Holiday, a sequel to The Best Man. About Last Night, though I don't know that that's really a
you know what I'm going to do?
Romantic comedy. But I will say that looking through the next 6, 8, 9 months, there aren't a lot of romantic comedies out. And you know what? That's an opportunity to make money.
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm actually going to take this opportunity to title this podcast The Death of Horror Film, the Horror Film Genre, or something like that.
Oh, to try and bait people into listening?
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, they'll say, how could any idiot say horror films are dead since they make money hand over fist?
Yes, our downloads will skyrocket. Our ratings will be off the charts.
Speaking of ratings, how were the ratings in television? It's the first week of the new fall television season. We're starting to get in the numbers. We don't even have all the numbers yet.
No.
So that's kind of before we even can talk about the numbers, you have to say, how long do we have to wait before we can talk about how popular new shows are? Because obviously the initial rating matters, just like the initial box office matters. But when you add in DVD and video on demand and all that stuff and worldwide, the story of a movie's box office success is very different sometimes from what you see in North America. Just the same way, a TV show's new ratings, it debuts on television, it has a rating. But then 3 days later, you get more information. And then 5 and 7 days later, you get more information. Then you find out how many people watch it on Hulu and Netflix and elsewhere. And suddenly, a show that didn't look like a hit becomes a real success story. So it's going to take a lot longer to know what's really working and what's not. But we can get a rough first idea by looking at the new TV season.
Well, you were right, Michael. A show that you said would fare quite well was Blacklist, starring James Spader over on NBC. I guess it was on, was it Monday night?
That's right, and I was hardly out alone on that. I mean, that's certainly their big show. They gave it their best time slot. Everybody was picking that show to do well, so I wasn't exactly, you know...
going out on a limb?
Jimmy the Greek here.
Yeah, okay. 12.6 million viewers, 3.8 rating.
Well, that doesn't really tell you. I mean, you know, come on, that's meaningless in and of itself. What if the show in front of it had 25 million viewers? Then it'd be
true.
A disaster.
Yes.
It did very, very well. It was a big success. It beat its competition on Monday night, which was Hostages. On CBS,
yes.
And Castle, the aging but delightful Castle on ABC. So it did really well on Monday night. It beat its competition. It held into its big lead in The Voice. It just dropped modestly. Hostages dropped far from Dancing with the Stars.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No. Hostages dropped from, what was their audience lead in? Oh, it was the...
Y5O?
No. It was the CBS Monday night block of shows kicked off by How I Met Your Mother. So Hostages on CBS did not do well. It dropped down from what the show did last year. It wasn't a disaster, but it's far, far back in the field compared to The Blacklist starring James Spader.
I'm sure the producers of Castle, that's exactly the way they wanted their show described. Aging but delightful.
Well, I like Nathan Fillion. But there you go. So The Blacklist was a big success, as we predicted.
So was Sleepy Hollow.
Well, I didn't predict that because I saw and thought it was laughably bad. What astonishes me is not that Sleepy Hollow opened big, but that next week, wait a second. This is Monday, isn't it? How do I know week two numbers? I guess it opened 2 weeks ago.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, yeah. That the second week, I thought for sure it would drop hard because it was such a ridiculous bad show. But in fact, it held on really well. So it's possible that Fox has a hit. And thank God, because that's the only success story they have. Fox is having a very rough beginning to its television season. The X Factor's way down. Glee already looks so tired. You're like, why is that show still on the air?
And I have to say,
I
saw both Sleepy Hollow this past week, second episode that I've seen, and more than likely the last. And Glee, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's it. I just wasted 2 hours.
I mean, Sleepy Hollow was so dumb.
Yeah, pretty much.
It was really, I mean, I enjoyed watching it because I was laughing at it. And I thought, well, people aren't going to come back week two, but they did. So apparently, sometimes dumb works. And the X Factor's doing poor. So Fox had a very poor first week. NBC had a great first week. It's actually won the week in the most important demo to advertisers. It's number one. The number one network in the demo that matters, the demo where you make money, NBC, which, you know, come spring may be hurting again because The Voice won't be on the air, but it's doing great right now. It's got The Voice. It's got football. It has The Blacklist. Chicago Fire did really well. It has the lead in The Voice. It's doing really well in its second season. So NBC is on fire. So, you know,
they better get something ready for midseason because they're going to lose 3 nights of programming.
That's true. But at least they're starting to build on the success of The Voice. They have The Blacklist, they have Chicago Fire, and they have on Thursday, they finally planted their flag again modestly with the Michael J. Fox show. Let's talk about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, I guess it got beat out by the Robin Williams show. What is the Robin Williams show called?
The Crazy Ones.
Yeah, The Crazy Ones. And so I guess it got beat out by Robin Williams show. And so everybody's saying, oh, it's not as successful as it could be, though you have some pushback against that.
Well, CBS has a great Thursday night lineup of comedies. The Big Bang Theory opened up with 18 million viewers.
That's astonishing. I mean, it's remarkable.
That's more than last season. It did better in its debut episode than it did last season. And then it followed with another new episode, which had 19.5 million viewers. So this show, and frankly, I was at my brother's this weekend. They watched an old episode on DVR, another episode on video on demand. I mean, on Netflix or something. You know, they just watch episodes of The Big Bang Theory. So, you know, this is one of those shows that somehow, even this well into its run, keeps getting fueled by people finding it and watching it and enjoying it in syndication and on streaming and all that sort of stuff. And it still maintained its popularity. So that's a huge success story. So it had 19 million viewers leading into the new Robin Williams and Sarah Michelle Gellar comedy, which is about Mad Men, advertising agents in the modern day era. And it had 15.6 million viewers. So it dropped a little bit, but it held solidly onto its Big Bang Theory lead-in. Right. So that's a huge success story. Michael J. Fox, on the other hand, is on Thursdays on NBC, which has been dead in the water for a good 5 years now. They've had The Office, which is a critical darling, but they have shows they rank in top 80, top 90, top 100. I mean, their shows are so far down on the list, they had nowhere to go but up. So Michael J. Fox at 9 o'clock averaged 7.3 million viewers. That's well below The Crazy Ones, but it doubled, more than doubled, the audience leading it had from Parks and Recreation.
Which is huge, by the way. I mean,
to double your ratings is crazy. You can't ask for better than that. You know, it doubled the ratings of the show that led into it. So, and then it had another episode right after that at 9:30. And everybody watched that who watched the episode at 9. So they clearly liked what they saw. It doesn't mean The Crazy Ones is doing poorly, but the Michael J. Fox show did great. You could not ask for much better than that, than to turn the lights on Thursday night on the sitcoms for NBC. That's as good as it gets. There's no lead-in, no out-in. It's going to be hard to maintain that pace. The Crazy Ones did well, too. We'll have to see how they come back in week two. But, you know, it's certainly a solid sampling and couldn't ask for more from NBC.
Well, and I guess over at ABC, the big news is all about the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's right. The show had a huge opening, and we're starting to get some DVR numbers. So it opened really strongly, but not superstar massive like CSI on Friday night all those many years ago. It opened to like 12 million viewers, and it had the highest like young demos, 18 to 34, in like 6 years or 5 years or something like that. I can't remember. But it was their best debut in ages in that demo. Like, everybody who watched that show was young. You were not middle-aged or old if you watched the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And if you were, you were in the minority. So yeah. I'm in the minority.
Well, this is kind of the superhero Avengers spinoff.
This is a spinoff of the Avengers. It involves real people, not superheroes, who are in part of the S.H.I.E.L.D. And their job is to go out and, you know, track down vaguely extraterrestrial paranormal happenings and goings-on that they can deal with without the aid of the superheroes. So they're a team of misfits who work together to beat the bad guys. As a sort of appealing cast, it's sort of a kiddie show. I don't know if you watched it, but it felt like The Incredible Hulk or Wonder Woman. It's sort of geared towards kids in a way. It's family friendly, but clearly younger people are going to like it more than adults.
The mother of one of my daughter's friends is in the show. So
Which character does she play?
Ming-Na Wen.
Oh, well, she's one of the grand old doms of the show. She's one of the older, more mature. She's drawn back into the field work when she just wants to stay behind a desk. We don't know what her backstory is yet, but she's a fun actress. She did well. There's good actors in it. I mean, the more established actors are good. The young kids I'm not sold on yet, but we'll see how they do. I don't know if I'll watch it regularly, but she certainly, you know, acquitted herself well in her action scenes.
Yes.
It had sort of a Back to the Future end to the episode where a car suddenly takes off and is flying through the air. That felt a little goofy and teenagerish to me.
That
something like a
ridiculous.
12-year-old might say, oh, that's cool, but it felt kind of dumb.
It did, yes. I was like, really? That's your ending? Okay. That makes me not want to watch the next episode. Congratulations.
I had the same reaction. But it wasn't embarrassing. It wasn't stupid. It was fine. It had some nice, some banter. And it certainly had a successful sampling as far as young people. So, you know, they could have wanted to, you know, a dream success would have been a lot bigger than what they did, but it certainly was a strong, strong opening and great numbers. Their big problem is 10 p.m. Nobody keeps watching ABC. If they can get anybody to watch the network, they tune at 10. They're the new series, Lucky 7, the season 2 debut of Nashville, which they had high hopes for, their Betrayal and 2020, and all of them did poorly at 10 p.m. Wow. So that is a real problem for The Castle, the show that I like. That's one of their few bright spots, and it has a lot of tough competition. We'll have to see how it holds up. They have Scandal, which will open next week, or this week, I should say.
A show everybody seems to love.
That show, it will be expected to grow, so that will thankfully give them some success at 10 p.m., but that's the hardest part for them. CBS, they seem to be resting on their laurels a bit. You know, I don't feel like there's any big new shows yet. The Crazy Ones could be a bright spot. But other than that, their story is NCIS, Person of Interest is slipping, CSI, How I Met Your Mother is in its final season, 2.5 Men maybe in its final season. They've got a lot of aging,
I guess the question
shows.
Is, what I say to that is, 2.5 Men is still on?
Yeah, it's still on. It could be its final season, given the cost of keeping it on the air. They're going to spin off another NCIS. CSI has been on for so long. Person of Interest is not building as you would hope it might, because it's a brand new series, but its second season, it's not building up great. So they're still the number one in viewers. They were number one in the key demo last season. They don't want to give up that crown, but they need to start getting more fresh shows that don't feel like the same old CBS shows. But over in England, of course, shows are debuting in the fall all over the world. And if there's some great show that's been a breakout hit in your country, let us know, and we'll check it out and see what kind of show it is and if it could travel to the U.S. or be duplicated here. Downton Abbey, of course, is one of the biggest hits in the U.K. That will be coming to U.S. in the winter, but it's already debuted. It's had 2 episodes on the air, and it's doing great. It debuted with 9.5 million viewers last Sunday, and its second episode rose to 9.6 million viewers. And that season debut is its best debut ever. So it's still growing its viewership 4 seasons in. So that's great news. And it's holding on to virtually 100% of its lead-in. And what is the lead-in for Downton Abbey on Sunday nights in the UK?
Ironically.
Simon Cowell's The X Factor, which also had about 9.5 million viewers last weekend and the weekend before. So The X Factor is a huge hit in the UK, as it is everywhere else in the world, but it is really not working in the US. And if you think, how big is that a deal? 9 million viewers. It'll put it in perspective. That's 40% of the people watching television on TV that night. So Sunday night, if you're watching TV, 40% of the people watching are watching The X Factor and Downton Abbey. In the U.S., you don't even hit 20% anymore.
Well, now, speaking of percentages, you might recall iTunes Radio launched, at least here in the U.S. and maybe one or two other territories. But here in the U.S., it launched last week, a week or two ago, 45%. Of 45% of people are
No. In 1 week, it has 45% of the audience that Spotify has.
Right. And Pandora.
Spotify has 24 million listeners.
Right.
And in 1 week, Apple's iTunes has 11 million listeners to their iTunes radio. So
correct.
In 1 week, they've got 11 million people logged in, listening to it and playing music.
Yes.
Is that right? So yeah, the 45% number was very confusing. They have in 1 week, they've managed to gain as almost half the audience that Spotify has. So hey, that's a pretty quick start. But of course, they have hundreds of millions of people who listen to who use iTunes. And therefore, when they launched a new iOS 7 and I updated my phone, there is iTunes Radio right on my phone, just waiting for me to press the button and check it out. I haven't done it yet, but there it is sitting there. And so you can be sure that other people will get, you know, clued into it, or friends will say, hey, you should check it out. So it's a great launch, right? They've got all those tens of millions of people and they got serious sampling in its first week. What does it mean? It means that the Pandora stock went down. Investors said, oh, Pandora's in trouble.
It went down 10%. That's a huge right. number.
And Apple stock rose 5% with right. the launch of the new iPhones and the new operating system and iTunes Radio. It's not strictly due to iTunes Radio, but the reaction was positive. Is that reasonable, Sperling? Is that make sense to you?
Not at all, because I think that Pandora's been around for a while. I think iTunes Radio people are kind of just experimenting. They're there to sample it. Will they come back? I don't know. I was there. I went to iTunes Radio. I listened to it for like all of about a song or two. I don't think I listened to a full song, actually. Will I go back? You know, I've got Spotify. I've got Pandora. I'm kind of locked into those ecosystems already. Mm-hmm. Will I go back? Maybe every now and again, but it's not going to make the rotation.
It offered nothing new to you?
Not that I saw, although, you know, if somebody can convince me otherwise, I'm willing to listen.
Well, their argument is they have so much information that they'll be able to better predict what music you'll enjoy and create a better experience for you. And they've got a lot of data to back that up. So maybe in 3 months or 6 months, people will say, oh, I really enjoy iTunes Radio. That might get you to come back and sample it again.
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. My habits, my listening routines, if you will, they can change. In fact, Spotify, Pandora, and TuneIn, which are these, they're
streaming services.
Yeah, and they're all apps on Android or iTunes. They formed this audio task force. The whole thing is silly, but really,
what's silly about trying to market your business?
Yeah, that's all they're trying to do.
It's not silly, surely.
Well, I guess they did this research that said, hey, more people are listening to online streaming. Yeah, no kidding. Thanks.
So they did a survey and said our industry is doing great.
Yes, correct.
53% of Americans listen to internet radio, which is a generic term to talk about streaming radio or on-demand radio and other stuff like that. So Pandora, streaming live radio, on-demand music, whatever you want to call it, it's all called internet radio. And over half of Americans listen to it, I guess, once a year or once a week. I'm not sure what they mean by 53%.
I guess I have no idea.
But it's true. I'm talking about my brothers again. I went there this weekend. How do they play music? They play it via Pandora.
Yeah,
they put on a thing, they pick a type of station, and the music gets played out through their iPhone, through their Bose speaker system.
You know, I was at Amoeba Records the other day. Now, Amoeba Records is one of the largest record stores now in the world, but when it started, it was kind of a big used record, new record store. It's well-known here in Los Angeles and in Berkeley, in the San Francisco area. And I came across a couple of albums used that were really good prices, $6.99. And I had this huge, like $200 in credit over at Amoeba. And what did I do? I said, do I really want to own this album? Do I really want to buy this album? Or do I just want to listen to it on Spotify? And I walked out without purchasing anything. I think it's the first time in history that I've done that. And I realized, wow, as I'm walking out, my habits have changed. I'm being more picky and determining which albums I actually buy based on whether I can listen to them on Spotify or not.
Why bother? Because you can just play them for free.
Right. Well, not for free, but yeah, or free, or I can, download them on Spotify or rent them, so to speak.
Well, I gave my brother a CD and he's like, what do I do with this?
Yeah,
exactly. It's kind of ironic.
Did he start using it as a coaster? Did he like put his drink down on it?
Yeah, and you got to actually walk into a record store, which is a rare opportunity these days, a well-stocked record store with a lot of new releases. You don't find those anymore.
No, not at all.
I'm in New York. It doesn't exist. You can find specialty stores with used records, but no strong supply of new releases. So I can't even have that experience.
Where do you go to buy music then? I mean, do Amazon or
iTunes? I don't. My purchase of music is way down because there's nowhere for me to go.
So what you're saying...
I get a lot of free music, of course.
So part of the issue then becomes the distribution channels are disappearing. They're drying up.
That's right.
And so iTunes, Amazon, these are the only places to turn to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of ironic. I mean, if you look at home entertainment, we've gone to such great levels with movies and television. We have widescreen TVs. We have Blu-ray players. We have great sound systems. The experience of watching a movie or a TV show at home is stunning. It's theater quality. It's never been better. And yet with music, because of convenience, we've gone way backwards again. Just like we've dropped down from LPs to cassettes and 8-tracks, now we've dropped back down from CDs, which were great sounding, down to crappy MP3s being played over a little tinny sound system in our home. Stereos don't exist anymore in a lot of homes. People just play their MP3s or they play internet radio, and the sound quality is a lot poorer, but it's more convenient. But that's strange how much better we've made our experience watching movies and TV shows and how much worse our experience is with music. Please save us, Neil Young.
Yes. Well, who's Apono, I think, is his enhanced listening. Now, I guess, you don't buy music on iTunes.
I do
iTunes.
Buy some music, and if I do, it's either Amazon or iTunes. And, you know, I still try to buy a CD every once in a while, but it's harder. And sometimes I just want a single, and I cave and buy a digital album or a digital single on iTunes.
But, you know, I will buy the Arcade Fire album on CD. I will buy the new
Pearl. But you got to work to do it.
Well, I'll just order it off of Amazon and it will come in the mail.
Yeah.
That said, I tend not to purchase things on iTunes, and I haven't gone through to make sure that all of my purchases are there. Have you checked your iTunes now that you've upgraded to iOS 7 to find out whether all of the purchases you've made in iTunes throughout history, whether they're still there?
Well, you could count the purchases I made in iTunes on one hand. So it doesn't really matter. I buy very little via iTunes. I really do buy CDs, or I get the music from from music publishers directly. So I don't have any music to check out, really. I don't really buy.
I mean, why
music.
Why would it disappear? Why am I asking this question? I shouldn't even have to ask this question. Of course, it's still there. You purchased, whether it's 5 singles or 5 albums. Of course, it's still there because you purchased it.
Well, but that's what we know. In the era we live in, you don't get to purchase anything. The music seller and the bookseller will tell you, you don't own that book, you don't own that album, you're just licensing it. And so what's happened is that the iTunes music library should have everything you purchased. But guess what? Sometimes they lose the rights to have that music in the iTunes library. And if they do lose that right, then that music gets pulled from their library, which means it gets pulled from your list. So if you paid for a song, and you think you own that song, you don't. And if Apple doesn't have the right to feature that song on iTunes, it's going to be gone. And so you paid your $1.19 or whatever it is for that song, and it's disappeared from your library. And you can't say, hey, where's my song? Because they'll say, well, sorry, we don't have the rights to that anymore.
Now, if you downloaded it.
And this is happening, right?
Yes. If you've downloaded.
Well, how did you come to this story?
It was on Hypebot. It was on GigaOhm. It was on a number of media.
And so people realized it wasn't the switch to iOS 7. It was simply that they lost the rights to some music, correct?
Correct, yes. And it's not that, I mean, if you downloaded the music after you purchased it and it's on your hard drive, you still have it and you can still listen to it through iTunes. But if you do what I do and what Bob Boylan does, Bob Boylan of NPR, All Songs Considered, who's been on the show in episode 151, we had him on the show to talk about how he deleted his iTunes music library and it's all stored in the cloud now. Well, part of the problem with that is when iTunes loses their license to sell a track or to feature a track, as you mentioned, it disappears from the library. And I guess this author from or this writer from GigaOhm, Jeffrey Goetz, wrote to Apple and said, hey, where are all these songs? And this was the response he got back from Apple customer or iTunes store customer support. They wrote, I understand that you are not seeing the songs on the list. I'm afraid to inform you that the items may no longer be available, or if they are still available on the store, they have been modified by the content providers since you have purchased them. I understand the inconvenience of this case. However, we won't be able to make the songs available for you to download again.
So this only affects people who don't download the songs onto their hard drive.
Correct. Which
but
a lot of people aren't.
But of course, that's supposed
now.
To also be a backup, where if you lose your hard drive or something breaks down, you're supposed to be able to get all your music again.
That's
so ultimately,
right.
It will affect everyone.
That's right. And when you're selling, you know, a MacBook Air with 128 gigabytes and you're selling, iPhones with 16 gigabytes of memory, a lot of people are using iTunes Match as their kind of or their iCloud storage as ways to store their music.
So this is just another reminder that we need a big court case, because the idea that you don't own the music when you buy it is absurd. Wherever it's stored, if you paid for a book, you paid for a movie, you paid for a song, you own it. And we have to have a court case to clarify this up.
Yeah, somebody get me the Supreme Court on the phone, would you?
Right, there will be a court case at some point.
Well, and you'd think, oh, this is really only, you know, iTunes. This is only a problem with iTunes.
Oh, no, it's Amazon. It's everybody.
Yeah, but Amazon just last week, they turned, you know, they're trying to challenge iTunes. And initially, you couldn't buy music through their downloadable music listening app. I guess it's the Cloud Player.
You had to go to their website.
You had to go to their website. Now, last week, at least on the PC, not the Mac, you can purchase songs and music directly through their app on the PC. That's a direct challenge to iTunes, but the reality is, much like iTunes, I'm sure they'll run into the same problem.
Well, but that's not because of the cloud thing. If you don't download it and you store it with their cloud service, no matter where you bought it, if they lose the rights to feature it, you can't get it.
That's right.
Right. So this doesn't really change anything. Even before that happened, Amazon would offer to store your stuff in the cloud. And if you did not have your own copy of it and they lost the rights to present that licensed music, well, then you could never get it again.
That's right.
You'd have to buy it all over again. So this is the problem. People buy hundreds of, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of movies and books and music, and then they disappear when they die. They can't donate. They can't give them to their children, their grandchildren. They can't sell them. They can't rent them. They can't loan them. All these are rights that you should have for your purchases that have to be clarified by a court case.
Right.
Got to go to court.
Well, and Bruce Willis wanted to do that, didn't he?
Well, we don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well, somebody needs to do that at some point, but it hasn't happened yet. And when it does go to court, it will be a big deal.
That is true. It must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, NBC announced it planned to make a miniseries about Hillary Clinton starring Diane Lane. CNN announced acclaimed director Charles Ferguson, Inside Job, he won the Academy Award for, he would make a documentary about Hillary Clinton for theatrical release. Now both projects are dead in the water, with the miniseries fading quietly from view and the documentary kiboshed by the director when he realized no one would give him any interviews. Ironically, the documentary fell apart because the Republicans feared it would be too quote-unquote pro-Hillary, and the Democrats feared it would be too damaging. Ferguson wrote on Huffington Post how he interviewed Bill Clinton and was astonished about how easily Clinton lied about one of the pieces of financial deregulation that occurred on his watch. So this is President Bill Clinton. Wow, I thought this guy is a really good actor. And that's a quote, wrote Ferguson. Maybe now the Republican National Committee would like to fund the project rather than fight it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, projects that were announced don't happen. In that case, I think if I was Hillary Clinton, I would love to have Diane Lane play me in a movie.
That's true.
I mean, good God. I'd love to have Diane Lane play me in a movie. Who wouldn't like that? But the documentary, I think it's a shame. I think the reason it fell apart is fascinating. I think it's just poor timing in a way. It's not that it isn't good timing to make it as an election comes up. Of course, people care about the topic. But when you are trying to get interviews, forget all the media publicity brouhaha. If she's going to be president, people want to stay on her good side. Not a good time to get people they're worried. What if she's president? I don't want to tick her off. So you're not really going to get great material probably at this point in time as she gears up for her big run for president. So that raises the difficulty in getting good, candid interviews right away. Is at the end of her presidency or, you know, people who are challenging her, then you can get people to talk. But when she's about to come into power again, potentially, that does make it much harder for you to do a good film. And obviously, her people didn't want to cooperate because they were worried he was going to bring up a lot of negative stuff. And the Republicans didn't like it, which is kind of stupid when you think about it, because having a documentary perhaps critical of Hillary by a noted, you know, liberal filmmaker would have a lot more weight than if some, you know, Fox News right winger does it. You expect them to hate them, but if Ferguson said something critical about her ties to Wall Street or big business, that would really carry weight. So they may have really blown it.
Plus, you could always, you know, write fake reviews as soon as you were, you know, anything that was released.
That's right. I do think, though, the miniseries was a terrible idea, because just dramatically, I think it's a bad idea, especially at this time. You know, it's just, while it's all going on, it's too soon. And the documentary, I guess, is poorly timed. And there is a good documentary to be made. Hopefully, it will be made down the road.
Now, speaking of fake reviews, as I just mentioned, could fake reviews actually become a thing of the past? One of the hardest parts of browsing for info on books, or frankly, restaurants, or hotels, or, well, just about anything, is trying to figure out which of these items has received genuine positive reviews and which has paid for fake reviews that rave about whatever it is, whether it's a hotel or a book or a restaurant. Now, New York State is doing something about it. The New York Attorney General announced a crackdown against 19 quote-unquote review mills that will end their false advertising and pay $350,000 in penalties. An investigation found fake reviews being generated for everything from restaurants to lawyers to dentists to ultrasound clinics. And this is a quote, "What we found is even worse than old-fashioned false advertising," said Eric T. Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, as reported in the New York Times.
And a man looking for higher office down the road.
Yes. Now, continuing the quote, he says, "When you look at a billboard, you can tell it's a paid advertisement. But on Yelp or City Search, you assume you're reading authentic consumer opinions, making this practice even more deceiving." Now, what I would say to him is, City Search, really? Does anybody still go to City Search? Anyway, could this mean an end to all those fake reviews of books and other items on Amazon and Yelp? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal, especially if it gains traction and people actually start to pay a price for doing this. I think it's a very reasonable thing to say that you should not be able to pay for fake reviews. You know, and it's a part of the internet growing up and maturing that you can start to police and regulate yourself in this way and have other regulatory agencies come in and make it better. It will be to everyone's benefit if companies that are paid to create fake reviews fall out of business. And I love the quote from the story we link, that there are fake reviews of fake review companies. And they have in the Times, they talk about how in October 2010, a review appeared on Yahoo that said the writer was, quote, thrilled by the services provided by Main Street Host. He added that he just didn't understand, quote, why this company gets all the negative reviews, end quote. He also said, for the record, I am not a MainStreetHost.com employee, don't know anyone who is, and have no knowledge of anyone else's experience but my own. Of course, it was written by a Main Street Host employee. By the way, Showbiz Sandbox is the best podcast I've ever heard. It changed my life.
Well, Dish Satellite Service, it continues to win a string of legal bouts over its Hopper and Slingbox offerings. ABC lost an injunction against the Hopper service that lets users tape the entire primetime schedule of all networks for watching at their leisure. And now Fox has lost its attempt at a preliminary injunction against Dish, offering a combination of Dish Anywhere, aka its DVR service in combination with Slingbox. On the bright side, for the network, CBS is able to take to trial the argument that Dish's momentary memory lapse about offering the Hopper service was grounds for the network to rescind its retransmission deal with the satellite service. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal that they keep winning. I don't see how you can argue people can record one show, but when they record four shows or 20 shows, suddenly it's illegal. You know, oh, you can't record the entire prime time schedule. That's crazy. It just doesn't seem possible to argue that that's wrong, but other stuff is right.
And it's being recorded on the device itself, not in the cloud?
Right.
Okay.
I don't know how it works technically, but I also am not sure about the, you know, digital anywhere. You know, everyone wants to watch their TV shows that they pay access for. They think they should be able to watch it on their tablet, on their phone, on their laptop, wherever they are in the world, frankly. And it seems to be to everyone's, you know, benefit to try and make that happen. I don't know why they don't work harder to do that, why they put so many roadblocks in front of them. I guess they want to be able to charge people twice for it.
Google's controversial program to scan books and allow searches for passages and data mining was once a huge, high-profile case. Now the battle between the Authors Guild, who fights, well, everybody, and Google looks likely to end with a summary judgment by Judge Denny Chin. It began in September of 2005. It almost ended with a poor settlement that was haggled over for 3 years. And now there may not even be a proper trial since the judge believes there are no questions of facts in front of the court so he can make a ruling right away. Google argued that its scanning was transformative, that being able to search books aided scholarly research and data mining, and that the possibility of someone pulling together all the snippets available online to get a free copy of a particular book was highly unlikely and perhaps impossible without a copy of the book itself in hand, and hardly worth the trouble. In contrast, the Authors Guild was stymied at almost, well, every turn. The judge is expected to deliver a ruling soon. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop because the world has passed this by.
Yeah, nobody cares anymore.
Yeah, well, they don't care anymore because I think Google has won the war. It just seems silly now to say, oh, you can't pop, you know, everything that they've said has proven true, I think, to a great degree. I don't think they're ripping off authors. I think that they're you know, I mean, there's a lot of complicated stuff about, you know, public domain books and what aren't public domain and all that. I understand that. But as far as the general practice, I think it's perfectly defensible. I don't see how anyone can say otherwise.
If you really want to look into this topic further, a great documentary I saw in Sundance is worth viewing. It is called Google and the World Brain. It's all about the scanning of books and how France saw it and how the U.S. saw it. It's quite fascinating.
Illuminating, yeah. Interesting. Yes.
Speaking of interesting, a Kickstarter campaign has led to a statue in downtown Detroit of the sci-fi movie character RoboCop. A fan thought it would be a cool idea, launched the campaign, and I guess it was on Kickstarter, and now the 10-foot-tall statue of mechanized officer Alex James Murphy is being built and will go on display in the summer of 2014. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
I mean, and it's poorly timed. The reboot comes out in February of 2014, so surely the statue should be up by then.
That's right. If this was an elaborate publicity campaign, it did not work, unless it's an elaborate publicity campaign for the DVD and the Blu-ray.
There you go.
Now, how much should you charge for letting people watch a season of TV? Guess what? It depends on how many episodes there are, how long they are, and what people are willing to pay for them. That's the lesson Apple learned over Breaking Bad.
Don't give any spoilers away!
Yeah, I was going to tell you what happened with Apple and Breaking Bad, but if
oh,
you don't
okay. Want... I got okay. scared. I got All scared. Right.
Well, AMC decided to split the final season into two parts. Now, they're doing the same thing with, of course, Mad Men. 8 episodes aired 1 year, and the final 8 episodes just ended just last night in 2013. 16, you know, for 3 seasons, Breaking Bad had included 13 episodes per season, and Apple charged $23. So when the final season included 16 episodes and viewers paid $23 for the first 8, they assumed that would also include the final 8. Nope. Apple tried to charge another $23, or about $8 each, for the 3 extra episodes. Fans balked. And Apple finally threw in the second half of the season for free. Hopefully they've learned their lesson and will price accordingly when it comes to Mad Men and The Walking Dead, both of which feature split seasons. You really don't want fans of a zombie horror show to be angry at you. I can tell you that much. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a pricing thing. If you can get people to pay, you want to get them to pay. But it was stupid on Apple's part and they waited too long to solve this. They should have just used common sense and said, wait a second, you know, there are only 8 episodes. Why are we charging the full price for just 8 episodes? It didn't make any sense. It was stupid.
The retail chain Target is getting into the video on demand business with a new service called Target Ticket. It's launched with just 30,000 films and TV episodes.
Which is almost nothing.
Yes, these days. And it has offers of both sale and rental via a wide variety of platforms like Roku, Samsung smart TVs, Xboxes, and more. There's no monthly subscription, and their big pitch is that the service is, quote, family-friendly with lots of common-sense guides to content and parental controls like filters that permit kids to watch only the content the parents want them to watch. How are kids going to pay for it? That's what I want to know. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, but it's good. The more competitors there are, the better it is for the studios and the networks and for consumers. It's not a monthly subscription service, so that's good. They've got their little gimmick of family parental friendliness, so that's how they find their way into the business. Basically, they make it easy. You don't pay a fee. You just show up. If you've got Target already, you go to their website. You happen to see something's available. You might buy it or rent it, and there you go. You've done something rather than go to Redbox or somewhere else, and they've made a couple pennies. I guess the point is they've got the huge digital distribution network. You have to build a really robust website if you're Target, correct? And so you've got the ability to do it. So maybe why not do it? Is that part of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, and they can also market it in the stores. They can market to their customers. It worked for Walmart with Vudu. You know, Walmart purchased Vudu, and it worked with that platform. So Target is hoping to do the exact same thing. This is not a startup.
But it's not a gimme. Like Best Buy tried to do it. It didn't work for them.
No, not at all.
It's not a gimme. But when you do have to have a really robust, good website, I assume it's a little easier for you to add this extra service. Not that it isn't a huge, complicated endeavor, but I assume they probably already had a very big digital presence.
Yes, and they had a lot. Yes, they did.
Okay.
Fans of Star Wars wrote an open letter to J.J. Abrams about how to make Star Wars cool again. They created an animated video with their message, posted it on YouTube, and in a week, they've already racked up 500,000 hits. It has reasonable, sometimes insightful comments like, Star Wars isn't cute, as in not kid-proofed or kid-friendly, and that Star Wars is dirty and beat up in its looks and set, it's set on the frontier, for Pete's sake. That is, the settings for the first three movies were in harsh, natural environments and had the feel of a Western. The last three were often set in cities and in Parliament. Ugh. It's a two-minute short with some fun animation and ideal homemade-sounding score with voices singing the theme music. That's kind of fun, actually. Sounds just like that. Hold on, let me just tell my assistant we're going to be getting a call from a copyright lawyer. Adorable, right? Yes, but it's also actually a calling card for a company called Sincerely Truman, based in Portland and devoted to story analysis and consultation on projects. Their latest endeavor might just do the trick. Those 500,000 views are slightly more than their second most popular video, which grabbed some, well, 3,000 hits. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's a fan mash note, mass, you know, but it's actually a promo for this business, and it's kind of clever, but that's the power of the internet. You know, they're actually doing what their job is. They did it for free on something they're passionate about and had some, not wildly insightful, but reasonable comments to make about the Star Wars franchise. And you know what? It's worked. It's gotten them a lot of attention, a lot more than they ever had before. So I wouldn't be surprised if they got some business out of this. And frankly, if J.J. Abrams watched it and followed it, it would help make the movie better.
Well, that's not saying much. I mean, it's not hard to make better movies than the last three movies, the prequels.
That's true.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. And get ready. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And, well, this one is a... It's an elephant. It's a, you know, how are we going to describe all this?
You better do it, because it's all about audio sound systems, and I know nothing.
Well, James Gardner of Digital Australia, well, he's in Australia and with a company called Digital, and he runs a blog called CineTechGeek.com. He wrote to us, he says, "Hello, guys, just listened to the show where you mentioned Dolby, and I believe that was episode 205. I have to say, Sperling, you really destroyed that topic. And by destroy, he means did such a great job that I just totally..."
Not exactly.
Okay. He goes on to write, "Not only do I feel you have it very wrong..." Oh, I guess he didn't mean that. "About proprietary in cinema being a good thing, so proprietary technology in cinema is what he's referring to, but you failed dismally in sharing the important aspects of the topic. Michael appeared more confused on the topic by the time you moved on."
And not that isn't common.
I was going to say, and to that I say, "And what makes that different from any other subject we cover?"
Nice.
"Audio is the new step in the evolution of cinema. Going from compressed 5.1 or 7.1 surround sound to uncompressed audio has been a great first step. However, the improvement in audio when using new immersive techniques is more noticeable in many respects than a digital picture is over a film one." So he's saying the audio makes a bigger difference than the visuals. "It must be noted that the immersive audio, quote unquote, is not new. They have been doing it in computer games for years. How this is done is a contentious issue. Dolby has developed a proprietary system called Atmos. Dolby would like to think they are the bastions of quality, as they won with Dolby Digital, becoming the de facto standard for 35mm film. However, I would like to remind people, film audio processors used to cost $8,000 to $12,000. Today, now with open standards and no IP, no intellectual property licensing, we have sound processors as low as $2,000. More on that in a moment, I might add. NATO expressed, and NATO is the National Association of Theater Owners, expressed their advice on this topic, in essence sharing their recommendations to wait for an open standard and not move on proprietary implementations, such as Atmos, in its current form." Now, a side note, they did that earlier this year. "DTS, which was a competitor of Dolby's for two decades, has released an object-based standard," more on that in a moment, "along with its rendering implementation," meaning how the sound is played out through speakers, "into an open standard. This means any sound processor maker or audio authoring tool can now implement this standard without licensing. The implementation in terms of exhibition will not have any licensing costs. Dolby can easily implement this renderer, as it's based on software, into their Atmos system." So he's saying that DTS, Dolby's competitor, has released this new technology that Dolby can use as well at no cost. "Consider this as Photoshop, which opens PSD files." That's their format, the Photoshop file format. "But they can also open PNG and JPEG and TIFF. and other open standard file formats. Other companies such as Barco Datasat and the Oro system have picked up this move from DTS. USL, which is a manufacturer of cinema audio processors, and others may as well. Competition will result, and a more cost-effective result should hopefully be the end result here. There are reasons why the Hollywood studios went with open standards for the conversion to digital. It will save them exhibition and ultimately the moviegoers money. Finally, on the topic of innovation, yes, Sperling, in an area where there is no technology that can do the job, yes, please, companies innovate and take the spoils from that innovation. However, in this area, we do not need to innovate. We have plenty of technologies already in existence that can answer this evolution in cinema. We do not need to create new proprietary technologies to do the same thing, so licensing fees can be charged. Hope this is not too long. I'm sure Michael will differ with that. I also glazed over many aspects. True, but needless to say, thank you, James Gardner, for writing in.
All right, so Sperling is going to take issue with some of the things James says, but want to thank him for writing in because it was a very confused discussion of digital audio cinema. And, you know, any chance to talk about it and maybe speak with a little more clarity is very helpful. So James is saying, hey, look, we've got this new sound system approach. It's called object-based audio addendum. Good God, I don't know what that means.
Wait a second. The addendum is an addendum to a requirements document that all the studios, they got together and formed this group called the Digital Cinema Initiatives Group.
And they want to make sure that theater owners can commit to a certain technology without fear that it will become outmoded or outdated or be the wrong one and everybody else will back something else, right? They want to say, here are the standards for presenting movies, here are the standards for audio, here are the standards for this and for that, and we want to encourage everyone to know what the new standards are so they can comfortably invest in the technology of the future, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so they came out with a new statement on audio systems, on audio formats to be used in the cinemas, right?
Yes, they did. Well, it's not necessarily a standard because, again, DCI only publishes requirements and they only speak through publishing documents. In this case, they added to their requirements specification version 1.2.
Oh, yeah.
Now, get this. Version 1.2 was written in 2006. They haven't been able to update it because of the virtual print fee contracts, because the virtual print fee contracts, some of the studios reference the actual version 1.2, and if they go to version 1.3, then they'd have to go back and rewrite contracts. It's a big mess. But so they wrote this addendum saying, hey, all of these formats that deliver object-based audio. Now, object-based audio is different from channel-based audio. So if you have surround sound at home, you've got six speakers, you know, five surround speakers and a woofer. So that's channel-based audio, and that's what's broadcast on television and what's on DVDs and Blu-ray.
And in most theaters.
And in most theaters, quite, yes. That is the way all audio is played back in theaters. However, object-based audio, rather than relying on channels and saying, please send this specific sound to the left rear channel, the left rear speaker, just places objects, a bird, a plane, a stick breaking, whatever it is, in space inside the room. So
if they want it to be coming over your head, it sounds like it's over your head. But instead of spelling out what sound goes to what speaker, they say the sound will sound like it's going over your head. It sounds vaguer to me.
Vaguer?
Yeah, it sounds vaguer to say, oh, well, it's just going to sound like it's going over your head and you figure it out? Or how does it work?
Well, there's an algorithm, and that's all the proprietary technology that people like Barco with Oro 11.1 and Dolby Atmos and others have created. And they're using psychoacoustics to play that out through the speakers.
Okay, so there's been the old way of doing sound, which is based on what speaker is where in the theater. Now there's this new object-based audio, which is a new way of presenting sound in the cinema. We think it's going to be a step forward in improvement. And the studios have announced through this DCI that they want it to be open source. They want it to be an open source code. Everybody will follow these standards. And so nobody will be slaves to a certain audio system like Dolby Digital and have to pay them a licensing fee every time they play a movie.
Right. And there was a whole battle back in the early 90s between Dolby, DTS, and Sony, all of which had their own 5.1 surround sound that was synchronized with 35 millimeter films. They had digital sound that was synchronized with an analog celluloid strip of film.
And they all wanted to become the market leader. They wanted most theaters to use their technology and thus get the licensing fees. But it wasn't even so much the money they got from theaters playing and using their audio system. It was the fact that if they were in most theaters, they could market themselves to people and people would see the Dolby Digital name all the time. And then when they went to buy their home stereo system, when they saw Dolby Digital there, they said, ah, it's just like in the movie theaters. And they would pay for that stereo system with Dolby Digital included on it.
Correct. Yes. So they would sometimes even just break even in cinemas, although on 35 millimeter film, they were doing quite well. But really, it was a bigger play for marketing to what is called the consumer market.
All right. So now we're switching to something that's been done in video games for a while. Uncompressed audio gives you more possibilities, more variableness, more richness in the sound, I assume.
Well, it's uncompressed. It's uncompressed. So you mentioned that you didn't like the sound of MP3s. MP3 is a compressed format. They're taking some of the data, some of the sound, and they're saying, the human ear isn't going to hear this. Let's just get rid of it and compress it down. So let's take everything over a certain frequency that most humans can't hear and underneath a certain frequency, which, again, most humans can't hear, and let's just really compress it down. Instead of 1 gigabyte of audio, maybe we'll have 300 megabytes. So that's what compressed audio is. Uncompressed audio is not doing any of that. It's just sending the raw, uncompressed audio to the speakers, to our ears. Now, that's done through a cinema audio processor. And as James points out, the cinema audio processors are now $2,000. Having been the product manager on one of the leading audio processors in the market today, I can tell you the cost of goods sold, that's not counting for R&D and marketing costs and all of that, they're making between $200 to $250 on that particular product, manufacturing-wise. So that is...
But they're only going to sell at most a couple thousand or 10,000 of them, right?
Correct. And you have to begin to wonder, why would you even bother?
If you're going to make... Because your market is just movie theaters in North America. And how many actual movie theaters are that would buy, like, tens of thousands? Like,
there's 120,000 commercial screens.
Uh-huh. But... How many of those would each need a system? All of them?
Well, in some form or another, yes.
Okay, so you have a maximum, but you could sell 120,000 copies of your product at most.
Yes. Effectively, what DCI has done, now again, this is the 6 or 7 studios getting together, saying, well, Dolby Atmos has this new sound that is being used in video games, and Barco has their version of it. DTS has an open standard.
And we don't want to fall into the trap of paying them a licensing fee every time. So let's just make it open source and say, to heck with you. We're not going to pay a licensing fee. You have to use an open source standard that will keep prices low and avoid a license fee. So why is that bad?
Well, also, it avoids the need to do more than one mix. With DTS and Dolby, you have to do a mix for each format.
The studios did.
Yes, and it was costly. I mean, you not only had to do the mix, you had to, you know, do quality assurance on the mixes. It was not, the workflow was... complicated.
Substantial, yeah. So now they're making it easier for them and cheaper for theater owners, but you don't like it. Explain to us why, James, you disagree with him.
Well, okay. You're saying, why do I disagree with James?
Yeah. And the studios.
Well, I understand why they want to go to an open standard for distributing this content, because digital cinema content is distributed via an open standard called the digital cinema package.
Why shouldn't audio be the same?
They didn't specify it originally. They let a whole bunch of people go out there, and it's a completely different technology. And I get why they want the distribution of that technology to be standardized. And as they write in this addendum that we mentioned, they write, though object-based audio rendering, meaning the playout, may be carried out differently by individual systems, meaning Dolby Atmos or DTS, etc., it is required that said audio in the DCP, these digital cinema packages, consider that a reel of film, be interoperable within all digital cinema systems, within all digital cinema systems that support object-based audio. What they're saying is...
Everybody's got to be able to play back. You can't, if I put my CD into your CD player, it's got to play back.
Correct. Exactly.
Which is perfectly reasonable.
Exactly.
And you don't want to have to buy just a Panasonic CD player to play Panasonic CDs.
Exactly.
You want to be able to play back your CD into any CD player you find, whether it's a Bose or a Samsung or my Walk Sony Discman or whatever it might be.
They also go on to say that object-based audio should be represented, meaning it should be distributed in the package, in a common format standardized by SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, that is interoperable with these digital cinema systems.
Right.
The object-based audio format shall be interoperable amongst the different object-based audio rendering systems, independent of a specific rendering system. Now, it gets complicated.
And, it already is.
And very technical.
Stop. Don't go into it then.
But effectively, I believe that, look, if you want to have Atmos, and Atmos is a proprietary system, Atmos has to, and Dolby has to figure out a way to get that package in to a DCP, and Barco has to figure out a way to get their audio into a DCP.
I don't even know what a DCP is.
The digital cinema copy, without it breaking the existing systems. Basically, the studios are saying, we don't want to pay to have our films mixed twice.
Uh-huh.
What they're saying is, oh, you know, we see this new technology coming to the market, and we don't want to, we're going to say, you know what, as a group, we're not going to use it. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that they are a group of 7 to 8 buyers. They're the only buyers, and they're the only ones that can mandate this. Therefore, there's some antitrust issues, but...
Well, so you think there's antitrust issues. You're also concerned that we have this new system now. We have the uncompressed. We have open source. We can have this new audio system. But you're worried there won't be innovation in the future if companies realize that when they come up with something new, they're not going to profit from it.
Correct.
Right.
Yes.
So what is the best argument that James makes? What is his most convincing argument? The one that you agree with the most or you understand the most?
Well, the one that in which he says, hey, you know, for digital cinema to take off, we needed interoperability. Absolutely correct. He's absolutely true. Without interoperability, there would have been a big problem. Everybody would have been trying to push their own standards, push their own technology, and we never would have gotten anywhere. When a studio released a film, they would have had to have released it one version for Dolby servers and another version for another set of servers. It would have been a huge problem. Whereas 35mm, you just punched sprocket holes in a strip of film and sent it out. It was the same way for 100 years. And, you know, so coming up with those standards, yes, that was a good idea. But now that we're pushing envelopes, and I understand that it's not new, that it was done in video games for years. Now that we're doing some of this, these add-on technologies, whether it's in 3D, why do you think everybody was innovating in 3D? Because it was the one area that DCI, these studios, had not specified. Audio was, except for uncompressed audio, all of these audio add-ons was another area. If you can't build something and create something
and
make money at it, you will stop creating something. And in a way, Atmos was never going to make any money in cinemas. It would make very little in comparison to what it would have made in the home or what it will make in the home. And that's really what Dolby's endgame was get these films mastered in Dolby Atmos, and then they'll be ready for the home market.
Well, so you're anti-open source.
No, I'm anti-open source in a market where, in this particular market, in this particular instance, there's a limited marketplace for this in the cinema space, and therefore, they're going to need to market a proprietary system. That said, telling the industry what you need to make your system work is like saying, hey, please give me your recipe. Mm-hmm. And it's a secret formula. They're allowed to have, I mean, maybe it's patented and they can figure it out anyway. But right now, you'd be breaking a license if you did that.
So they can't cooperate without giving up state secrets to how they create their audio systems.
Or foregoing a license fee.
Mm-hmm. Well, the studios are winning right now. Is anybody talking about suing them for antitrust?
No.
Dolby's not, clearly.
No, although I do think this is one step where, because they're basically saying, okay, we did this one requirements document for the very start of digital cinema, and we've added to it here and there, but this is going a step further. This is going, oh, and this other thing. Now that you're making money at X, Y, and Z, we'd also like to include that.
Well, thanks, James, for writing in. I hope we showed enough respect to your opinions, even though Sperling took issue with them quite strongly.
Well, I mean, I take issue when somebody says, you know, hey, we have, audio processors for $2,000. Great. You basically... It's a race to the bottom. It costs $2,000 to make the device. And yes, you now have the devices at $2,000. People will stop making them, but at least you're buying them at cost.
All right.
Well, I mean, that's what's happening.
Okay, I don't understand any of that. I hope you cut down this conversation dramatically before releasing it to the world. But if they do listen to it and they do want to talk to us, how do they reach us?
Well, they can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, and you can respond to us via Twitter as well. Our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook and leave us a message there. Facebook, if you just search for Showbiz Sandbox, that's how you'll find us. Of course, all those ways to contact us or follow us or like us can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or any one of the podcast aggregators out there. And we do appreciate it when you rate and review the show. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we talked about this week, including the DCI addendum that I just mentioned, they can be found on our website, too. That website, again, is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, which is whoismgmt.com. And tonight, they can be found in Oslo, Norway, and they just announced a whole slew of new dates throughout October, November, and all the way through December 13th, where they will be playing in Brooklyn, New York, their hometown.
All right.
Michael, you have a whole bunch of websites, starting with bookfilter.com, but where else can we find you?
Please don't tell me the ending of breakingbad.com.
I think that domain is already taken.
Probably. You can also find me at michaelgiltz.com.
And some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. I can also be found at sperlingspeaks.com. I restarted my Tumblr blog.
Thank God. I've been waiting for that for weeks.
Until next week, play nice.